Why would elite power interests have favored Trump over Hillary Clinton in the recent presidential elections? What does the makeup of the Trump cabinet tell us about the policy thrust of the new administration? Are the major anti-Trump demonstrations a weapon against or a tool of the ruling aristocracy? Are the elites divided? At what point might the secret government pull the plug on the Trump presidency, and by what mechanism? Is there a connection between Trump's rise to power and a possible crash of the U.S. economy? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, on the occasion of the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump, we take a deeper look at what is going on behind the scenes to determine how political events are being manipulated to achieve elite ends and the consequences for American democracy and perhaps the future of humanity. Our guests include progressive journalist and radio host Jack Rasmus, professor of economics and author Professor Michelle Chosudovsky, and writer and ecological campaigner Mark Rabinowitz. On this week's program, Trump and the Deep State, Part 1. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 20th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Oxfam International Executive Director Winnie Byanyima called it, quote, obscene for so much wealth to be held in the hands of so few when 1 in 10 people survive on less than $2 a day, unquote. If the present trend continues, one or more trillionaires may top the super wealth list in another generation. Predatory capitalism enriches the few at the expense of most others. Growing inequality pulls societies apart, said Oxfam. Quote, it increases crime and insecurity and undermines the fight to end poverty, unquote. That comes from the article, Globalization and Social Inequality, Obscene Wealth of 8 Mega Billionaires, by Stephen Lendman, posted January 18th. At any time during the administration of Barack Obama, Manning's sentence could have been both vigorously opposed and commuted. However, it was not. Manning was left to languish in prison, unjustly confined, so an exiting U.S. president could perform a spectacle, adding to the illusion of both his own legacy and to that of the office itself. It is fitting that the United States at this juncture in its history cannot even exhibit positive qualities without polluting them with self-serving political and manipulative agendas. Regardless of the depravity that defined both Manning's imprisonment and release, it should be remembered by all that despite Obama's pardon for each day Manning was imprisoned unjustly, or anyone for that matter, a crime is being committed against us all. That comes from the article, U.S. Army Whistleblower Manning's Overdue Freedom Granted Amid Shameless Political Stunt, by Tony Cardellucci, posted January 18th, originally appearing at Land Destroyer Report. In what seemed like a giddying rush, old Soviet foes, the Baltic states, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, became card-carrying NATO members, happy to become forward bases for Washington's weapons. Murmurs of encouragement were then sent on their merry way to Georgia and Ukraine. As the sole superpower and the Soviet Union unraveling, promises were there to be ignored. The Russian bear had repaired to the forest of desperate isolation to lick its wounds, powerless to hold any sway over the decisions made to its west. Now resurgent, that bear remains curious to see how a Trump administration will deal with NATO. That comes from the article, NATO, an obsolete Cold War military construct, Donald Trump and the History of the Atlantic Alliance, by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted January 18th. Scanning world history, even in the era of Google, one is hard-pressed to identify more than a handful of women who are widely acknowledged as outstanding public figures. English language web lists are regrettably dominated by American personalities. So what has Nepal to offer beyond its current president, chief justice, and speaker of parliament? Perusal of Nepali postage stamps by my colleague Sukanya Waiba offers more models than expected. In a list of 18, in addition to goddesses Sita and Shrina, wives of the Hindu god Ram, Maya Devi, mother of Gautam Buddha, a living goddess Kumari, Princess Brikuti, daughter of an ancient king, and three 20th century queens of the Shah dynasty, we find noteworthy secular leaders. That comes from the article, Nepalese Women, Symbols of Historical Achievements and Political Leadership, by Barbara Nimri Aziz, posted January 18th. For the first time in U.S. history, a CIA director openly charged a president or president-elect with betraying the country and threatened the incoming chief executive. He coldly warned Trump to, quote, just make sure he understands that the implications and impacts of Trump's policies on the United States could be profound, unquote. Clearly, CIA Director Brennan has not only turned the CIA into a sinister, unaccountable, power-dictating policy to an elected U.S. president by taking on the tone of a mafia capo, he threatens the physical security of the incoming leader. The worst catastrophe that could fall on the United States would be a conspiracy of leftist and rightist politicos, the corporate mass media, and the quote-unquote progressive websites and pundits providing ideological cover for a CIA-orchestrated regime change. Whatever the limitations of our electoral norms, and there are many, they are now being degraded and discarded in a march toward an elite coup involving elements of the militarist empire and intelligence hierarchy. That comes from the article, Regime Change Comes Home, the CIA's Overt Threats Against Trump, by Professor James Petrus, posted January 18th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Dr. Jack Rasmus is a progressive journalist, radio host, former union organizer and local president, and author of just published books this past year, including Systemic Fragility and the Global Economy and Looting Greece, A New Financial Imperialism Emerges, both by Clarity Press. In an article he authored for his blog, jackrasmus.com, he speaks about the ways and means by which the economic establishment can tame Trump in case he steps too far away from that establishes priorities. He joins us now by Skype. Good morning, Dr. Rasmus.
Good morning.
So for all of the criticisms that are being leveled at Trump currently, legitimate or not, I'd like to take this discussion to a deeper level. And I'm curious to know, in your opinion, why the U.S. aristocracy and elements within the military and intelligence establishment might favor Trump over Hillary Clinton. At face value, she does seem to be the more loyal to that elite constituency, given the links with Wall Street and defense contractors and so on.
Well, I think you should see the Trump phenomenon as kind of a split within the ruling elites here in the U.S. And the capitalist class and so forth. Trump has a lot of financial capital backing. He has a lot of the more aggressive wing, the Koch brothers, and although they didn't support him at first, they did eventually. And he kind of represents a feeling, I believe, within the class and manipulation of the small rural business and small professionals and so forth, the ex-Tea Partiers, there's an alliance there between them. And I think they felt that the U.S. was about to face some real challenges and they needed to shake up the whole approach of the ruling elite here. There was a feeling that, China was resurging and that the U.S. was spending too much time fighting in the Middle East and opposing Russia, whereas the real challenge and threat was going to be China and in Asia. And you know, the Obama administration could not extricate itself very well or very quickly from the Middle East and from this hangover from the Cold War, this neocon fixation on Russia, which was very strong within the Obama administration, particularly in the State Department. The State Department and Hillary was focused on, you know, Libya, that was her war, and the Middle East, and neocons in her department, Nuland and others, were pulling off coups in Ukraine and arming Eastern Europe and so forth, and sanctions against Russia. And I think part of the ruling elite felt that this was the wrong focus in terms of foreign policy. I think also they began to become aware that domestically this income inequality problem was really becoming severe. And they had to address that somehow. And, of course, the major cause of a lot of that is the foreign trade policies and the loss of jobs and so forth. And they felt there was an opportunity to really play to the working class discontent, particularly around the Great Lakes, the industrial heartland that's just been hollowed out terribly after 20 years of NAFTA and all these other bilateral free trade agreements. So I think they saw an opportunity to manipulate that discontent and shift the policies in the U.S. Away from the Middle East and Russia and towards China, because Obama was not able to do that. We should look at the Obama administration as a failure to reestablish the neoliberal order after the crash of 2008, to reestablish it sufficiently. And what we're going to see with Trump is a kind of neoliberalism 2.0. They're shifting and re-emphasizing certain things, and they're definitely reorienting politically towards Asia. You're going to see a green light for Japan to rearm. You're going to see more meddling of the U.S. In Asia, in South Korea, and in other parts of Asia as well. That's the big shift. So it's kind of the more aggressive wing of the capitalist elite in the U.S. have taken over now.
Now, I'm curious to know what the makeup of the current cabinet is. How that informs you. Maybe you can give us some, if that maybe confirms some of the suspicions that you have about this new foreign and domestic policy agenda, this new trajectory of neoliberalism you speak of.
Right, right. Well, it's a mix, isn't it? I mean, there are some elite figures, Tillerson, Rex Tillerson, and others occupying the main cabinet roles. In other words, State, Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, Mnuchin, and others, bankers, again. You got a lot of Goldman Sachs people in there, again, right? But yet you have, in the lesser import for making money, you have, in those cabinet roles, you have the more right-wingers, right? The people coming in, Betsy DeVos, and education, and other positions. So it's a real mix, and it reflects this new alliance of the new aggressive wing of billionaires who want to change the policy. And that's the reflection of the alliances, the new alliances that are now entering, you know, control of the political scene in Washington.
Hmm. Are you with some of those individuals I think that some of these individuals that they've had some been at cross purposes with Obama, Mr. Flynn, for example. And so I'm thinking, is there maybe certain policy trajectories that you can glean about, like, you know, profoundly different directions they might be going? I'll just give you an example. Oh, go ahead.
I think Syria is a good example there. You know, the neocons tried to push Obama into a land war in Syria. He resisted that because that, the U.S. military did not want to get into that. The neocons tried and Hillary tried to push that. I think you're going to see a fairly quick deal over the Middle East between the U.S. and Russia and other forces there. I think it's very clear the U.S. is going to turn away from pushing sanctions and Eastern Europe, sanctions against Russia and Eastern Europe. You'll see a sort of a status quo freeze in the Ukraine conflict there. And you'll see a more aggressive, we're already seeing it, turn towards China. You know, I think Trump is going to raise the red flag of he doesn't care about a trade war. And come on, China, this is a bargaining chip by Trump here. And other indications that he's lining up for a bilateral deal with China, not just on trade issues, but on a whole host of other issues in the Far East. And I think another chip he's going to play is, okay, Japan, you know, remilitarize. Watch for that. It wasn't by accident that Abe was the first guy to come over and meet with Trump-elect, you see. I think they already have a strategy that's sort of in place. The U.S. position has been weakening in Asia significantly, politically and economically. You know, the Philippines president Duterte is, you know, popping off, and Indonesia now is a threatened Chase Bank that you know, they're going to pull the plug on them and rating agencies. South Korea is a mess in terms of security. So you're going to see a definite hard move to Asia. Hmm. And that's because Obama couldn't pull it off, you see. He talked about the pivot to China, but he couldn't pull it off because the neocons were keeping him engaged in Eastern Europe and in the far in the Middle East, you see. Obama, pretty weak president, doesn't want to aggravate anybody. Tried to pull out of the Middle East and cut a deal. He hoped that the Iran deal would snowball and he'd be able to cut some other deals. But the Hillary forces, the neocons, were too strong in the State Department. But now you're going to see that occur.
Now, what about it seems from there was a winning strategy as far as the rethinking trade. I mean, there's a lot of aggressive talk about NAFTA and the TPP. And so it does seem like a serious, at least in terms of the campaign rhetoric, a serious departure from the status quo going back more than two decades. So
I don't think it's going to be that much of a serious departure. I'll tell you why. I think he is a free trader, but I think he is a bilateral free trader. He's opposed, and it was a good tactic to oppose multilateral free trade deals like NAFTA and like the TPP. But Trump is going to turn around and negotiate bilateral free trade deals, one-on-one. He just feels, I think, that we didn't get as good a deal, and he can do better. You know, he's the big egoist negotiator. You know, he's the real estate wheeler-dealer here. He figures he can do a bigger job. But should make no mistake, he's going to be a free trader. But that's not the priority right now. The priority, is to change that maybe over the next 2-3 years, renegotiate some of those deals. But the priority, policy-wise, is big corporate and investor tax cuts. That's number one, and that's coming. And the middle class is going to have to pay with higher taxes in various ways. Also, gutting Obamacare, the ACA, is top priority. That's happening already. And Dodd-Frank. And as long as Trump goes after those items first, he's aligned with the traditional ruling elites. That's the common ground he has with them. And they'll play ball with him until they get their big tax cuts, till they get deregulation, till they get the end of the taxes on the rich that the ACA call for. You know, that's the thing that they really don't like, that investor tax and the 3.8% surtax on the rich and small businesses and so forth. So they'll go along with them on those items. Again, deregulation, tax cut, corporate investor tax cuts, right? Two big things. ACA, because he's promised that. You're going to see a kind of a dual administration here in terms of its policies. Trump will be very traditional on Republican primary issues, like I just mentioned, those big three. But he will act radically, appear radically, to hold his popular base on the right on issues like immigration, right? On issues like civil gun control, civil liberties, constraints, cracking down on protesters, cracking down on law and order, pro-police, that kind of a thing. It's a domestic strategy that's not unlike Richard Nixon, you know, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of similarities between him and Richard Nixon. If Nixon hadn't been impeached, there's a lot of evidence that he was planning in his second term to go after a lot of these domestic issues, mm-hmm. But he never got to do it, right? When Ronald Reagan comes in, of course, Ronald Reagan emphasizes first the tax cuts. He proposed even bigger tax cuts proportional to our GDP back in 1980-81. And he introduced the first to introduce free trade with Canada, by the way, and other initiatives like bringing to heel the Japanese and the Europeans with the Plaza Accords and the Louvre Agreement. So there's a lot of similarities. And, of course, he busted the budget as a result, and we got this terrible trade deficit as a result. There's similarities there between them. And Trump is not so radically different from this long trajectory of neoliberal initiatives in the U.S.
It's interesting you mentioned Nixon, because I'm reminded of some analysis that points to the fact that there's been this growing convergence between Russia and China and Iran. And in the Nixonian strategy, or actually the Kissinger strategy back in the 70s, was to kind of break up that to decouple those two major powers. So back then he was brokering with China, the whole, only Nixon could go to China thing. Now I'm wondering if this whole, friendliness with Putin is the other end of that same approach.
Yeah, it's the same thing reversed. It's cut a deal with Russia to pull them from China and go after China. Just the opposite of Nixon, but it is the same in that they're trying to split China and Russia, which have been growing much closer in recent years economically and militarily. They hold joint military exercises now. Russia is providing the oil and the pipelines and so forth to China, and a lot of technology and so forth. A lot of food trade is going from Russia to China. They're integrating quite closely. If you integrate the Russian kind of free trade zone there with China's attempt to develop a free trade zone, which they are now doing very well, the Silk Road idea, the Asian Investment Industrial Bank, all of those things, that's the real threat this new elite sees, and they believe that Obama couldn't pull it off because Obama's being dragged by the dumb neocons into yesterday's fights. Mm-hmm. The bigger issue is China and Russia uniting and pulling in other satellite states in Asia, behind them.
Now, going back to the idea of taming Trump, I mean, Trump does seem to be in some respects sort of a wild card. And there's certainly, a lot of concerns. I mean, like with recent press conferences, and it does seem like the intelligence communities are, trying to push him into a corner, or I'm not sure exactly what they're trying to do. But there does seem to be some opposition to him, even among elite circles. So I'm wondering, at what point does Mr. Trump outlive his usefulness, and how could the trapdoor be pulled from under him, if I could put it that way?
Yeah. Well, it's evidence of the split in the ruling elite in the U.S., right? And it's hard to tell at this point how much of the intelligence community's resistance to Trump is really appointees from the Hillary and Obama Democratic side. You know, how deep that really goes in those intelligence communities. We'll see after he puts his people in. Trump puts his people in the attitude of the intelligence communities. This whole dossier deal was, you know, kind of a dirty trick kind of a thing. It's really fun to watch that. You know, they're at best, I think they're trying to bring him to heel to get him to listen and more and follow their lead. They're trying to get him to cooperate with them more. And they're feeling him out, seeing how far he's really going to go, and so forth. So the resistance against Trump is continuing from that wing of the elite, however. I mean, you can watch the media, and New York Times, Washington Post, all of those are continuing to build the case against him. Conflicts of interest with his businesses, nepotism with his family, his tax returns. I'm sure they're holding that wild card, you know, in abeyance, and they're pumping up public opinion. And it takes a while to do that, to demonize somebody, but they're continuing that flow for the day when they think they need to pull the plug on him, or threaten to pull the plug if he doesn't come to heel. You see,
on your
That's where we're at. They're willing to let him do all the nasty domestic cultural stuff, immigration and police and, you know, crack down on folks and so forth, build the wall, you know, all that nonsense. That's how Trump keeps his popular right wing in tow, his tweets and all that stuff. And they know he's got to continue to do that. So they're going to let him do that. Now, once they get what they want with tax cuts and all the other stuff, you know, what happens then remains to be seen. It could be a real wild 4 years after the honeymoon's over.
Yeah. And I noticed in your article, Taming Trump, you mentioned that it does appear that they have some ammunition to use against him. So do you anticipate an impeachment, or do you anticipate some other something else they could use against him? What would be your best prediction, or do you dare?
Well, I don't think they're going to do anything until they get their horses in the barn. In other words, the tax cuts and deregulation and all those things that really matter to the wealthy elites in this country who run the show. Right? They're going to tolerate him until those horses are in the barn, and then we'll see whether he goes too far in terms of upsetting relations, trade relations, and money relations with China. That's the big thing. You know, will he come around on that and not provoke a trade war, threaten one, use it as a bargaining chip, but don't really do it? That remains to be seen how far he is really independent. And I mean, he's an egoist. You know, he's not going to be easy to bring to heel. I mean, those who I don't mean to imply that he's going to be easy to do. He tends to shoot from the hip. He may put himself in a corner he can't get out of. But for the first 6 months, maybe 12 months, I don't think they're going to criticize and go after him too much. After that, you know, we'll just have to see next year, 2018.
Dr. Rasmussen,
if he pulls out of NATO too much, in other words, he pulls too far from NATO, that may aggravate some strong resistance here. Or if he provokes a real trade war with China, that will provoke resistance.
Dr. Rasmussen, I want to thank you for your time.
We've
been speaking with Dr. Jack Rasmus. He's a progressive journalist, radio host, former union organizer, and local president, and blogs at jackrasmus.com. His forthcoming book this April is Central Bankers on the Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Next Depression, from Clarity Press. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We're having a discussion on Trump and the deep state, or those secretive forces in the background influencing events. And so joining me to further that conversation is none other than Professor Michel Chossudovsky. He's an award-winning author and a leading analyst of the New World Order, professor of economics and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Chossudovsky.
Delighted to be on the program.
My impression, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in past elections, the elites, if you will, seem to be united around one candidate or the other. And this time, it seems like they're, and I think you've said this yourself, that the elites are divided. And so you're talking about the Clinton faction and the Trump faction. Is it possible to give us a little bit more information? What do we know about what separates these two factions? Their priorities, their agendas.
Well, I think that you know,
it's not as simple as Democrat versus Republican, obviously.
Yeah, it's not something which is easily understood. What seems to have collapsed is this bipartisan consensus that they respect one another and so on, and they work together. And what is emerging is that there are very deep-seated divisions between factions within the elites, the capitalist elites. Now, that's something which is the reality of the financial world, but it's not something which is heralded. And there are all sorts of what I'd call cross-cutting alliances. In other words, you can be friends with your enemies and so on. And we know that the banks, the financial institutions, are each other's throats, okay? You have J.P. Morgan Chase, you have Goldman Sachs, you have Citigroup, you have Bank America. All these banks are ultimately, they're seeking profit and so on and so forth. And they have conflicts, and they have allegiances, and then there are the lobby groups. Now, what distinguishes Trump is that he's not really the product of the lobby groups. In other words, Hillary Clinton is supported by a number of lobby groups. Trump has his own agenda, his own donors, and that creates divisions. Now, the other aspect is that his foreign policy statements are very detrimental to the military-industrial complex. And I'm not saying he's making contradictory statements, but if he attempts to normalize relations with Russia, this constitutes a backlash to, you know, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, these big companies that really feed on a war rhetoric, and so that I think the main divide there is in the area of foreign policy. But at the same time, Trump's foreign policy agenda is not necessarily peace-oriented. He's threatening China. He's, of course, also taken on, he's supporting Israel against Palestine. So that we're not dealing with there are major differences in terms of foreign policy. The neocon foreign policy agenda goes back to the project of the New American Century, early 2000. It's continuity with the Bush administration, so on and so forth. And the team which Trump is putting together appears to have a somewhat different agenda. And so that there's a clash within the ruling establishment, which is very visible. What is at stake in these various protest movements, as well as the media propaganda, is what some people call the color revolutions, because we see them occurring in different parts of the world. But I have no doubt that there is a project to destabilize the Trump presidency. Okay? That project exists. And that is unprecedented in U.S. history.
So,
and that project to destabilize doesn't emanate from the grassroots. Okay, it's not people who are adamant about his racism, his statements with regard to women's rights, and so on and so forth. No, destabilization agenda emanates from segments of U.S. intelligence. It's backed by powerful corporate interests, including the defense, so-called defense industry, and so on. So we're dealing with something pretty complex.
You're talking about this campaign to delegitimize Trump. In a previous conversation, you mentioned the prospect of martial law in the wake of a constitutional crisis. You also mentioned the term colored revolution just now. And we have to keep in mind that these events are unraveling in the midst of a significant and unprecedented financial crisis affecting the lives of millions of Americans, growing inequality and poverty. And given how such dynamics have played out in Ukraine, you know, where they had a colored revolution, and other Eurasian countries, I wonder if we could similarly be down the road seeing dramatic consequences in the U.S. I mean, either premeditated or not, like a civil war or California breaking away and becoming an independent country. I don't know. What are your thoughts as we move down the line of where things could go with this?
Well, I think that what is more likely to occur is that following the inauguration of the Trump presidency, these attacks against him will continue. In other words, the media campaign portraying him as an agent of Moscow, smearing him in one form or another, this will continue, unless, of course, they come to some understanding. It is possible that following his inauguration, certain things will happen in the arena of U.S. foreign policy, which could lead to, I would say, a less insane foreign policy environment. In other words, the restoration of diplomatic dialogue with Moscow. Okay, I think that will probably happen. Whether this will actually lead to a major shift in foreign policy, that we can't say at this stage. Trump has expressed, and the people he's appointed also, has expressed the fact that he wants to go after China. I suspect that from a foreign policy point of view, the United States might orient itself towards breaking the alliances between Russia and China. Mind you, that's something which has been ongoing in any event. But in fact, it's been done the other way around. It's more or less attempting to incite China to go against Russia. I think that, yes, there is a possibility. Certainly, we're going towards a constitutional crisis, because if a president is inaugurated, and then within a few months of his inauguration, there's an impeachment process which is launched, that does create a constitutional crisis. But again, the Republicans control the U.S. Congress, so the question is, would this go ahead? That's another matter.
Now, it seems to me that his vice presidential pick, Mike Pence, is somebody that the Clinton faction would be comfortable with. You know, correct me if I'm wrong. So I'm wondering if there's a point at which Trump outlives his usefulness and he to the deep state, and his presidency might be terminated one way or another through impeachment or perhaps something more drastic. So even if Trump does as he's told by his advisors and who largely serve the will of the transnational elites, what do you think are the prospects he'll still be president in 2019?
Well, I don't want to start making predictions.
It's speculative, I know.
I think his vice president is more acceptable to the dominant neoliberal establishment. But at the same time, if you look at the people who he's appointed, you know, Mattis the Mad Dog, who will take on a very key position in the administration as Secretary of Defense, I think that there, as far as the war in the Middle East is concerned, I think it's continuity. Now, it's very difficult to disassociate the war in the Middle East from the confrontation with Russia, because the two things are intertwined. In fact, all these, you know, this buildup of military might on Russia's border, from a military standpoint, doesn't make sense, because the conventional forces are much larger on the Russian side. But it also is, it's a message to Moscow with regard to its role, let's say, in Syria. Now, the question is, how is that going to evolve? So I don't see major shifts in U.S. foreign policy. I would see more shifts in the arena of diplomacy. But that, in turn, could lead to solutions which don't necessarily threaten to lead to World War III, as in the case of a Hillary administration. Hmm. But you're absolutely right. We could go towards a martial law situation if there's some kind of constitutional deadlock. And the fact of the matter is that the martial law, the legislation for martial law, was passed during the Obama administration. So that we're not talking about something which is an abstract proposition.
I suppose you don't see these, as you call them, engineered protests as an instrument to dislodge this ruling hegemonic power.
I think that people across the United States have to realize that they have been, in a sense, that if they want to organize and mobilize, they have to do it and not ask Rockefeller or the Ford Foundation to give them money to do it. It has to be done. There has to be independent movements. But that's not easy to rebuild, because essentially organized labor now has been kidnapped by organized capital. The NGOs, a lot of these NGOs are funded by tax-free foundations. Ultimately, to articulate a protest movement, you have to really start building it from the grassroots. And you have to essentially understand how the elites manipulate the protest movements, and they manipulate they manipulate a lot of progressive organizations because they fund them. We know that the World Social Forum, was established more than 10 years ago, ultimately, at the outset, was funded by the Ford Foundation. And it's still funded by a number of corporate foundations. And the people within the World Social Forum, many of them are activists. They believe in what they're doing, but they turn a blind eye to the fact that the money, which is paying for their venues and for their administrative costs, comes from Wall Street. And the same thing is true for many other organizations like the Occupy movement. So you can't have a mass movement and then ask the elite, a mass movement against the corporate elites, and then ask the corporate elites, could you pay for our expenses? That has to be understood.
Professor Chossudovsky, it's good as always to speak with you. We look forward to your insights on these and other important developments. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we've been speaking with Professor Michel Chossudovsky. He is an award-winning author and leading geopolitical analyst, professor of economics, and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. You can find more of his analysis on the website globalresearch.ca. Mark Rabinowitz is publisher of oilempire.us, a political map to connect the dots. He's been a writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner for over three decades. He also has some insights into deep politics and deep events and how they have played out in the past. He joins us now to share his thoughts about exactly what happened last November. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thanks for the invite, and wish it was a happier occasion.
Now, Hillary Clinton had been backed by John Negroponte, Robert Kagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, and other neocons, generally recognized as being kind of aligned with Republicans. People associate them with that party. Yet we know the election machines can be rigged in favor of whichever desired candidate is out there. So why do you think Trump emerged victorious?
Well, there's a number of factors. Clearly, a lot more people voted for Trump than was expected by the powers that be. But it is worth remembering that if you consider minority voter suppression in some of the swing states, which reporter Greg Palast did great work to document, and you consider the faith-based voting machines we have in the United States and some states, that it is reasonable that the Clinton campaign actually won the election by a narrow margin. But beyond the technical details of election fraud, the real question is, why was the Trump campaign allowed to win by the deep state, given the heavy hitters who were backing the forces behind Clinton, some of them Democrats, some of them Republican? It is likely that the next 4 years is going to see the next economic contraction imposed by limits to growth and peak resource consumption. And Trump will both get the blame for whatever is going to happen, and it is likely he will be in place, or his cabinet will be in place, to impose the next wave of austerity and surveillance, repression, etc. This is going to happen whether we had Trump in office or Ralph Nader or anybody else, because in the United States, oil production is in decline. Fracking has peaked and has started its decline. Natural gas is similarly going into decline. And energy is the basis of any economy. As energy contracts, the economy will have to contract as well.
Now, I'm wondering about, because I've heard some beliefs that the ruling class itself is divided, and I'm wondering if, in your view, there's a this is one area where there is a consensus, because there is widespread belief that the war on terrorism was fundamentally an energy war. What is your understanding of how the different factions are choosing to address peak oil and gas and peak energy? Was that a factor in this election, you think?
Well, on the surface level, their response is just to deny everything in public. Look at the ridicule that's heaped on anybody who suggests the reason for the invasion of Iraq had anything to do with the oily stuff coming out of the ground, which, of course, is obvious. If it was about olive oil, we certainly would not have invaded. But more seriously, the deep state is not in complete alignment with itself over how to manage the situation. You have the what used to be called the Rockefeller Republicans or the realists backing Obama, backing Clinton. They went they would like a managed collapse. They're not quite as blatantly fascist as some of the forces behind, say, Dick Cheney or Donald Trump now. There's disagreements, for example, over whether to invade Iran. Cheney and Rumsfeld, a decade ago, wanted to attack Iran. And parts of the deep state, in particular parts of the military, did not want to invade Iran, not out of pacifism or humanity, but Iran is a military power that could disrupt oil flowing out of the Persian Gulf. And and if that ever happened, that would escalate the crisis in unpredictable ways. If that ever happened, the consequences could be extremely dire. And so Cheney and Rumsfeld were blocked from attacking Iran. It's another example where presidents can be thwarted from implementing their goals by the deep state, by the intelligence agencies and the military. And with the attacks that the Trump team is doing on these agencies, he is possibly going to wind up being the latest president undermined by the agencies that supposedly are under his command. We shall see. Maybe we can check back in a year or two and see if the CIA manages to undermine Trump or the reverse.
When you look at the composition of Trump's cabinet, what do you see there that informs your understanding of the way this administration will confront looming financial and environmental crises?
Well, the most blatant is appointing the CEO of ExxonMobil to be the new Secretary of State to direct America's foreign policy. This guy has plenty of experience going all over the world scouring for more oil supplies, but a diplomat he is not. You also have people tied to the Blackwater mercenary company. You have extreme military intelligence advisors like Michael Flynn. You have a guy nicknamed Mad Dog who's going to take over the Pentagon, who was involved in war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is, to call it alarming is an understatement. But these are not just crazy people. They're crazy people who understand that we are entering the downslope of energy supplies, and it's a mad scramble all over the globe to grab what's left.
Now, in the past, we've seen presidents JFK and Nixon and Jimmy Carter seemingly at cross purposes with the CIA, the deep state, and they didn't last very long. So I'm wondering, now we're seeing Trump apparently picking fights with the U.S. intelligence, people in U.S. intelligence and vice versa. So what do you make of that? Are we looking at an early termination for this president?
It's possible. It seems likely. But there's so many variables, it's hard to know precisely. I'm reminded of the term from the Cold War, Kremlinology, where the U.S. intelligence agencies tried to study what was going on in the Soviet Union to figure out what the different factions in their government were doing, because it was so opaque they didn't have press conferences or publicly disclose their decision-making processes. And for the deep state, the national security states of America, we may need a similar approach to understand what's going on in Washington. I live near a mountain range, and it's rainy and cloudy here today. So if you look at the ridge, you can tell there's a mountain range out there, but you can't sketch it completely. And with the deep state, it's a similar situation. You can see the shadow forces on the horizon, but to precisely describe what is going on between the Trump cabinet and the intelligence agencies is in the shadows. You can see echoes of it, and they're astonishing to watch on the sideline, but what's really going on behind the scenes precisely is not something that we are privy to.
So, again, I mean, I guess I'm putting you in a bit of a speculative corner here, but what would you anticipate, I mean, if we're looking at a very dire or catastrophic situation, could we be looking at false flags or something like that that could further enable these, you know, a deep state agenda?
Well, Trump comes into office as the least popular president in U.S. history, and that's partly a reflection of the fact he didn't actually win. When George W. Bush was president in his first year, his popularity also slipped. He also did not actually win. They had to steal the election in Florida and other places. And when September 11 happened, which they knew was coming and let happen, Bush's popularity went from the 40% to 90% overnight. That boost didn't last, but it saved his presidency, as we all know. Will something similar happen with Trump? Certainly hope not. But given the epidemic of alienated young men who are committing random shooting events, which are not false flags, but just a reflection of social breakdown, there's clearly going to be more violence. Whether we'll have another 9/11 or not, you know, who knows? But general chaos and mayhem that Trump will try to seize on, that seems certain.
Okay. And just before we close, looking at the wider public, what would have to come together for the public to be able to withstand what's coming? I assume you're not a huge backer of some of these rallies that are taking place, the marches and whatnot. Well, what would be maybe a practical strategy for perhaps capitalizing on the Trump presidency, if that's a possibility?
Well, we have to chip through the frozen layer of denial that is over all of these problems. We need to have honest discussions about election fraud. We need to have clarity about limits to growth as an underlying factor in the economic crisis. We have to recognize that what Trump is trying to do is capitalize on dissatisfaction and promoting what I call peak blame. And we also have to recognize that some of the narratives about what's going on are intentionally misleading, and that happens from the left and the right and other layers. There's a whole cottage industry of the conspiracy industry that's now been outed as tools of the government. When you have Alex Jones's InfoWars openly working for the Trump administration, disinformation has been weaponized as a tool of control. Perhaps the strongest antidote, apart from seeing beyond binary modes of thinking, that there's either a Clinton or a Trump and you have to support one or the other when neither is acceptable, is we're going to have to look at practical ways to relocalize as the global energy system breaks down. The more that we can focus on practical logistics instead of partisan politics, the likelier a practical, positive future will be for all of us.
Mark Rabinowitz, I really appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you again.
We've been speaking with Mark Rabinowitz, writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner, and he's also the publisher of oilempire.us.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. That's it for this week's program. Tune in next week for part two of this special look at Trump and the deep state. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.